The title of the talk is Equanimity and Balance. It's really clear that our spiritual journey is about being open, being aware, being sensitive, and allowing the world to come in, not shutting it out, being together, us and the world. Can't imagine a spiritual journey which is building walls, keeping out everything, shutting ourselves in the Buddha's castle or the Buddha's palace. We want to get out of the palace, into life. So if we're not hiding inside some castle of our personality or our protection or our walls, we actually need to develop some powers of balance and kind of inner protection. And I mentioned this before a couple of days ago. Because we will meet our vulnerability. Pekiyut. We will meet our vulnerability. It's part of our truth. And the spiritual journey is not about hiding from the truth of our vulnerability, our openness, the way life, like I said, kind of takes us to pieces. And so we have to find a way in which we don't run away from the waves of change, of difficulty, and yet be sensitive and awake and open. We need to be able to be right there in the middle of things, even if they're difficult. And that expression of Christopher that I like, that he often uses, when the pot boils over, don't leave the kitchen. Have to stay there, be there in it, turn off the fire, do something. Don't run away when the pot boils over. And attachment is not an option here. Attachment is the problem, not the solution. Attachment is what makes us afraid and needing conditions. Attachment is what makes us want to keep building the walls of the castle to make them more comfortable. It leads to a life of automatic function. It leads to a life of fear and insecurity. It leads to busyness with what I need and what I don't need and what I push away and what I want and what I don't want. The attachment leads to prison. It imprisons us. And it's not an option. It's not a protection. So we need to find a kind of inner protection, an inner armor, shirion pnimi, and that's equanimity. And that's in a different place from the walls of the Buddha's comfort zone. It's not in the place of building a comfort zone. It's in a place that allows us to be vulnerable, allows the truth to be there, allows the world in, even if it's painful. So there's a nice story that I told to one of the groups about this. And it's a story, a Chinese Buddhist story, about one of the generals of Genghis Khan that was passing through China, and he arrived at a monastery, and he knocked at the door of the monastery, and a monk answered, Buddhist monk. And the Buddhist monk just said, "Hello, who are you?" And he said, "What, you don't know me? I am general of the army of Genghis Khan, and I can cut you in two pieces without blinking an eyelid." So the monk said, "Well, I'm a monk," and gave his name, "and I can be cut into two pieces without blinking an eyelid." And this is an extreme story, but it gives a sense of the protection of equanimity. It's true that we may need to go to the doctor. We need to look after ourselves. We don't want to be cut into two pieces so easily. We go to do what we need to do. When we're hungry, we eat. When we're sick, we go to the doctor. We don't walk into the road in front of a bus. But this doesn't need us to be busy with protection. This happens by itself. If we're just allowing ourselves to be healthy and respectful to the body, we protect ourselves naturally. It's not an issue. The issue is not to make from that protection a life where we're busy with walls. So equanimity allows us to be open, calm, centered, flowing with change, vulnerable, and absolutely okay. It's one of the three calming factors in the Buddhist list of different qualities of being, of qualities of midot. It's in the calming side, and it's close to patience, savlanut. It's a place of balance. It's a place of steadiness. It's a place where things don't knock us down, or they can knock us down, but we never get knocked over. Things can hurt us. Things can make us feel shaky. Things can hurt. Things can be painful. But we're never knocked over. It's like that toy, Nachum Takum. Okay, go down, go up again. And actually, you know, the toy, it has a weight under, I seem to remember, at the bottom. And that's us. If we have a sense of steadiness, that's our weight, our inner weight, that gives us, like in a ship that doesn't keep rocking over because there's a weight at the bottom. In English, you call it ballast. It's a weight that, it's not really a weight physically. We can be very light and free. A lot of very long-term Dharma practitioners are almost like you feel you can blow them and they fly off. They're not heavy necessarily, but it's an inner sense of steadiness, an inner sense of presence that carries us through. We just can't be knocked over. Like the bend and you shall not break of Lao Tzu. You can bend and like a cane you cannot break. And it's an understanding that everything is workable. There is nothing forbidden, impossible, that we have to shut out. Everything is a raw material. Everything is workable, is gamish, is possible. We can work with it. Any experience is just the raw material for practice, for awareness. So this sense that everything is workable is a really important insight. And it's almost like if there's one feeling or sense that I'd like you to take home with you, it's that one, that everything is workable. Everything is we can play with it. We can experience it. We can work with it. It's not forbidden. It's not out. It's not too much. It's not, doesn't destroy us. It's the raw material. And it means we don't get overwhelmed. We don't drown in anything. And things pass through us, but they will not drown us. And we partly practice it here. Even with something very, very small, well, sometimes it's not so small, but just a pain in the back or pain in the shoulder, when you begin to move towards it and allow it and begin to work with it and begin to see it's actually not a thing. It's a relationship. It's dynamic. It's a music. It's a voice of the body. And I'm listening. And this listening to the voice of the listening self or the listening awareness and the voices are kind of dancing together, which makes it workable. It can be emotional pain, which we feel, oh, it's so much, it's so big, it's so everywhere. But as soon as we kind of feel that it's workable, yes, it's changing, yes, it's telling stories, yes, I'm with it, yes, there's movement here, it moves me, I move it, the whole thing is a dance, and it's changing all the time. Everything becomes workable. And that's the basically our inner protection. What equanimity is not, and sometimes it gets mixed and with it, and Yonatan mentioned this yesterday, it's not indifference, adishut. It's not a sense of, oh, I'm in perfect balance here, nothing can touch me, everything is in absolute peace, and this sense, which we sometimes there's an image of that in the spiritual life, that it's assumed that Buddhists, you know, you see the statues, that Buddhists are these kind of untouchable, kind of perfectly still, undisturbable statues. It's not about indifference. It's not about adishut. It's about it's the opposite. And there's a very nice line in T.S. Eliot that he talks about this. He says, there are three things that look similar. There is attachment to things and to people, and to possessions and to selves, and detachment, letting go of attachment of things and people and possessions and selves, and growing between them is indifference, adishut. And it seems to grow in the same hedge, gader chai, seems to grow in the same place, but it is as different from detachment as death is to life. It's a really beautiful line. It kind of looks like it, seems to be there, but one is death and one is life. Adishut is the death. It's like running away, stopping. I don't want. It's shutting down. It's erecting the walls again. You can't buy peace with walls. I think we all know this. You can't buy peace with walls. It doesn't work. And I think we have a tragic situation here in the Middle East, which just really, really shows it. You can't win peace by building walls. There's a nice story from the Chelmaim, the Chelm, the long story, but at the end of the story, the Chelmaim were very cold. They'd done their usual stupid wisdom, and they somehow lost all their heat, their fires, their wood, their this. So they decided, and they all got cold, they decided they wanted to build a wall around Chelm to keep the cold out. And you know what it's like. I'm amazed that Klil, where I live, is still one of the only communities in Israel, the Jewish communities that don't have any fences and gates and electric gates and tall fences around them. And it's such a pleasure to have no gates and have no fences, and everything's fine. It doesn't help you to have those fences. Actually, they have more stealing and more trouble in places that have fences than us. We don't have. For 30 years, I've never had any locks on my doors. We never built locks on the doors of my house. And most of the people never made locks on their doors. And 30 years we've been there. Anyway, the two movements that create equanimity, are trust and non-self or anatta, meaning not being full of me and mine. And the two work together to create equanimity. The trust is a kind of commitment to letting go, to letting down barriers, to allowing things to be what they are. And the non-self part allows things to penetrate without destroying us, to pass through us, like the image of the glass that we used the other day. Things can pass through, they don't destroy us. So the two together create this power called equanimity. It's expressed by the long ears of the Buddha. And some of you have seen statues of the Buddha with very long ears. And the ears symbolize the fact that he's so empty that he can listen to all the suffering in the universe without being destroyed. And the emptiness, or the sense of being transparent, shakuf, allows us to accept more and more and more of the pain of the world without being destroyed. Pain of ourselves, the pain of others. It's based on emptiness. It's based on things not sticking inside and working inside and creating pain, reaction, defense, fear. So it's our ability to listen to pain by being kind of not busy with self and me and mine, which allows us to open all the doors and let in everything, the pain and the joy. Rao Kan, a Japanese poet, said, "What's the heart of a sage, of a wise man? It's a gentle wind under the sky." It's a beautiful expression of it. What's the heart of a wise man? A gentle wind under the sky. And it does happen gradually, that if we don't run away from the waves and we don't stop them or try and stop them, that actually the waves get less powerful. It does happen. This is not adishut. This is just a natural process where we're less busy with protection. So things get less threatening. The waves get less big. They become ripples, advot. If we run away from the waves, they all seem very big. And they hit us. But if we don't run from the waves, we float on them, we allow them to beat, slowly they get less. And so we experience this when we allow a pain in the body. And this is really not something that we haven't experienced ourselves. We allow a pain, an emotional pain. We allow a pain in the body. We are allowing it like a gentle wind. It's happening. It's there in the being. And if we allow it and engage with it and touch it and listen to it and see the way it's talking and changing and it has a music and a life, this thing that we call pain, it gets less. It gets less. It gets less dominant. It gets less painful. It's less of it has less effect on us. And a lot of the practice that we've been doing here and that we're doing in basic Vipassana practice is just reducing the power of pain to work in us in an automatic way, creating me the victim, I don't want it, the automat of pushing away, the sense that we're reacting and we're busy with it, and afterwards hashlachot, we add it into our life, we turn it into things, we start addictions, we make trouble for other people, we let it work out through our life and then out into the wider world. So it doesn't work anymore. It doesn't have anything to do anymore. And that's kind of the way we practice in Vipassana, that we're fully there with the wave, but we don't run from it or push it or develop it or expand it or do anything with it. The pain talks and we just listen. And it just disappears, it moves, it changes, it goes. It doesn't work inside. It doesn't turn wheels. And so it gets less, because we just get less interested in it. It just doesn't get that interesting anymore. And then the waves begin to get less and less. We can still be with the pain. We can still be with the emotional pain. We can still be with the confusion. We can still be with guilt and with this and with anger and with fear and with body pains. They can all be there. But if we don't, they don't work inside us. They don't do anything. They don't make more waves and more waves and more waves. They get softer. The awareness can hold them. In a cosmic sense, in the big sense, the waves go through us because we and the world are one. There isn't a difference. There isn't really a difference. We are the world. We are the world. The world is looking out of your eyes now. And my eyes. Where can we say that we're different from the world? How can we say that? From what place can we say, I am not the world? The world is us. We are in, it's in us and we are in it. And so from that place, that's again a place we slowly, that the experience of meditation will show us that we're not so separate as we thought. That we stand under the tree and the tree is there with us and we are with the tree. The birds are with us. The whole of life is just present with our presence. We are present and life is present. And where is the boundaries? And that is a much, much bigger place of protection. Because if we and the world are one, who's attacking whom? You know, where is the threat? Where is the problem? There isn't a person there that is separate and trying to protect. nevertheless, this person, part of the world, will go to the doctor and take a medicine. And this person, part of the world, will not want to die by going into the traffic on Kvish Shesh and saying, kill me. It's just not why, you know, we respect life. It's just automatic. You look after your life just like the digestive system. We don't have to say, I want my digestive system, Marechet Ikul, has to work. I want it to work. I give it instructions. It's working. It does it. The blood is turning around. The heart is pumping. It's doing by itself. So we eat and we look after our body. And if we need to protect ourselves, we protect ourselves. It happens by itself. But that doesn't mean that we and the world are separate. It means we are, that things are happening by themselves, us and the world together. And this brings me to the big question of karma. And it's one of the most, in a way, difficult issues to understand and full of misunderstandings. It's basically, karma says, change is happening, and it's, change is not that interested in us. We want life to look after us, but life isn't that interested in us. Change is going on all the time, and why should it care about us? Me, the little me. No one asked me if I wanted to be born. No one asked me if I want to die. No one asked me if I want to get old. No one asked me what my parents are going to be. No one asked me even what my name is. No one asked me how my Marechet Ikul is working. Nobody asked me these things. It's just happening. So I'm a kind of result. And indeed, I'm the result of millions and millions and millions and millions of pieces of molecules and energies and electricities, and I'm put together. I'm a huge community. This body mind is a huge community, like the universe of pieces. So we're definitely, like the Buddha said, all compounded things are impermanent. You know, everything made of other things will pass, will change. We're made of other things. Carbon, Pachman, we're made of other things, so we will change because we're not separate. We're made of other things. So that's karma. The plan that makes us from all the rest of the universe, that sort of shapes a person, that plan or that blueprint, design is karma. So every person has a different design, a different blueprint. And when we act and how we are is changing the plan. So the way I act a little bit changes what happens next, or what happens in next life, or what happens in the next moment. So it's a dynamic. The plan is there, but the plan is built by all the beings before. And all the lives before contribute. The thing is dynamic. Karma is dynamic. It's not a fixed plan that just unrolls forever. It's growing itself.
There's an obsession with DNA right now in the world of science, and with the genes, genim, and everyone thinks if we solve the problem of genim, we know all disease, we will know everything. And I've heard that, you know, science says that again and again and again. If we just know this, we will solve all the problems. And I remember, because I used to be a molecular geneticist, I used to work in the National Institute of Medical Research in London as a research scientist, and in the genetics department. That was where I was working, and that's where I got my doctorate in molecular genetics. And I met a man called Francis Crick, who used to come by. I've never seen met such a pompous, full of himself, idiot. Totally pompous, nafuach, and, you know, and he felt, because he discovered DNA, and that was before he got, I think he got Nobel Prize, right? But that was before he got the Nobel Prize, but it was as if he already got it. Because he discovered it, and everybody was saying what a great scientist he believed he could tell you about everything. So he would sit there in the Medical Research Institute talking about art and about culture and about way science should be and the way the government should be and the way everyone should be. And I was arguing with him, of course. One of the things that is interesting in science itself has a kind of handle on truth, on a certain truth. It does, if you look at anything, if you look at with the eye of meditation at your hand, you will see some truth. If you look with the eye of a microscope, you'll see some truth. There is truth in there. It's not all non-truth. So, but it's an obsession. So you say DNA is the blueprint where everything, but that's because you pay attention to DNA. So you decide it's the blueprint. But science itself showed, and does show, and we were doing these experiments there, that actually nothing is simple at all. That DNA is built by other things, and other things are built by other things. And every principle and theory the next year is destroyed, because you realize it's much more complex than you thought. Everything is influencing everything else. And science is trying to make it very small. So we had lots of arguments about this, and in the end, they kept saying, well, you're just a vitalist, you're just a spiritualist, you know, they gave me all the bad names. I was arguing with them. But the point is that in wherever you look, you'll see the interbeing, interaction, the total way that everything is interconnecting with everything. And karma is kind of this dynamic plan. It's planning itself, really, in which we all contribute, and we are made by it, and we make it. And so in that big vision of karma, there's a real place to rest, because it means that equanimity will tell us we can't control things. We can't, things will be disappointing. We will try and cure a disease and then we cannot anymore. We will try and make change and we cannot anymore. I'm thinking of peace work that we did, many of us here. We've done so much work for peace. And where is it? Where's the peace? The more expectations you have, the more trouble you have. All you can do is offer your qualities, offer your energies, offer your insight to karma, and then let karma do what it wants with it. You can't do more than that. But that's a place of deep relaxation. That it's not on you to have to say what's going to happen. It's on you to contribute qualities, energies, the right kind of wisdom to every situation in life, and then karma will take it from there. It's not up to you. And it's a great help in equanimity to know that we are not in control. We can sow the best seeds we can, and we'll do that, and we'll do it more or less automatically. By itself, we'll just do it. Things will be disappointing. Things pass. We will not achieve what we might want. And the more we put pressure on ourselves for certain outcomes, the more disappointments we will have. But offering things is beautiful. And that's part of equanimity. It's the balance that allows us to offer things to the world without expecting anything back, without expecting things to be a certain way. And then we're in the flow of giving and receiving. It's just a flow. And there's a great freedom in that. And in the end, equanimity is more or less the highest state of being in the Buddhist tradition. It's where all the qualities of the person are in the end, it all goes there. It's like all the practice goes there. All the meditations go there. It's the kind of address. It's the place of peace. It's the place of ease and well-being. It's the place of steadiness. It's a place to rest in truth and not be knocked over by anything. And in this place, actions happen. We live a life of action. Actions happen by themselves. We can't stop acting or speaking or thinking. So we are living beings, so life is moving through us. Actions happen. And those actions, based on equanimity, are actions that have a great purity, and it's often a great power. And in the midst of all the change, if we ride the waves of change with equanimity, everything becomes, like I said, workable. Change is the basis of our actions and of our understanding. And the Buddha talked about, as a nice sutta that the Buddha quoted, he said, in the end, everything is like a gold, your meditations and your practice is like a goldsmith working with gold. That the equanimity is like gold. And it can be made into anything. The gold can be made into shapes, into necklaces, into bracelets. It's a raw material for any action, for anything you do. And he gave some story about a goldsmith that sometimes makes the fire, and sometimes puts the gold in, and sometimes makes a mold, and sometimes the fire goes up, and sometimes the fire goes down. Things change. But there's always gold. And the gold is made into any object that you want. Any jewelry. And, this image of purity, something very pure. Gold is the image of purity. Very pure. This image that this pure quality, value, can be made into anything is the image of equanimity. It's a nice image. It's basically awareness, which is pure, bright, clear, and it makes everything workable. And at that place, it's kind of where all the practice goes to. Thank you.